Everyone, good evening. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and Paradigm Shifters are all over our globe these days, and there are people that I have deemed anyway that are making a huge difference in the collective of our species. And our Paradigm Shifter tonight is doing some very exciting work with an old book called the Bhagavad Gita. It's a spiritual poem that has walked many a person through consciousness, through spiritual truth for what, 3,500, 4,000 years? And our guest tonight is Jack Hawley, who's a student of this kind of thing and has written the book so that you and I can understand it and apply it to today. So welcome to the show, Jack Hawley.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
I really, really love this book. And I just wanted to say this right off the bat. This could be a spiritual support for what's going on in our emotional and economic and political climate these days. It could be right for today, couldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. This is what's so wonderful about it. I think it's closer to 8,000 years old, not as a written document, but as a oral document. And it's just wonderful for today. I'm amazed at it every time I read it.
Yeah, and I thought that the beginning of it when Arjuna is... Well, for people who don't know, there's a battle going to go on. And Arjuna's cousin has stepped to the kingship, I believe, and he is taking hold. He's stolen land from a whole bunch of people. It's like got all the pennies in his own corner. You could call it a mortgage scam or something, right?
And, nowadays, that's what we'd call it, yes.
Yeah, but what I really loved is how Arjuna, talking with Krishna, who's an avatar, is helping figure out how he doesn't really want to kill, but he's asking Krishna, how do you fight? What do you do? How do you fight as a spiritual warrior? And so I want you to tell us, first of all, you've done a lot of studies on this, and you've written it in such a way we can understand it. So what's your attraction to India, and when did you start studying the Gita?
My relationship with this book is probably about 30 years old, but for the first 10 years, it really had various copies pass through my hand. Tried to read all of them. One I read more thoroughly than others because it was simpler and easier. And then I got after writing another book about spirit and management, and I'm a management consultant. I'm not a spiritual teacher. But I got a very strong message inside, and it was in the voice of my guru in India, saying, do the Gita, do the Gita. And my first reaction, Veronica, was, I can't do that. It's not my culture. I don't know that well enough. I absolutely butcher Sanskrit, and it's hard for me, and I had a thousand reasons why not. I think at the very core of all those reasons was laziness. I knew it was going to be hard work, and I didn't want to do it.
Is that laziness or just sometimes a fear of the challenge, maybe?
I think, yes. Well, me, I think those are interchangeable.
And so how long have you been studying? Like, you're studying with Sai Baba, right?
Yes, studying with Sai Baba.
And how long have you been doing that?
South Central India for over 30 years, 32 years, 33 years now.
Wow.
So I've been, and very earnestly, my wife and I, after our kids grew up, we kicked ourselves out of the house and went to India and have lived there half of each year for the last 30 years.
Oh, my gosh. That's really remarkable. So have you studied, you've been studying this kind of philosophy all the way along?
Well, yes. In undergraduate school, even, I was the last of the GI generation, GI Bill generation.
Hmm.
And I went to a state university in New York, down by this close to the city, and I was an art major there. So in those days, of course, you had to be an art major to do anything in the art world. And that was my beginning, formally, in studying this. So I studied Zen Buddhism.
Hmm. And this was after the 60s, was it?
Yes. No, it was just about the beginning of the 60s.
Hmm.
So I've been in it since then and in it deeply.
Wow.
And one of the things that I think solidified all of this for me and made it more than just a interesting pastime was our eldest boy died in an accident, a swimming accident. And we had to face that, my wife and I, and it was very difficult for us. And we had 2 years of hell and guilt and sadness and so forth. And the only thing, looking back on that, now at the time it wasn't as clear to me, but the only thing that really helped me and her get through this was this whole movement of ours towards spirituality, deeper spirituality, and looking into what is this world all about and why are we here and so forth.
And you went into meditation and so on?
Got into meditation, got into various teachers here in the States. And then a friend of mine, a business friend, a fellow that used to work for me, actually, wrote me, and we talked a lot, he and I, about spiritual matters. Well, I suddenly got a pencil postcard from him, pencil-written postcard from him from India. Saying, Jack, I'm here sitting on the veranda of divinity itself, and I'm spending as much time as I can with my guru, Sai Baba, and you've got to come here as soon as possible.
Hmm. I love that line, veranda of divinity. The thing about the Gita that I love is the fact that it talks about how to be a warrior inside and how the outside world, none of us is ever going to really find our peace there. It's the inside world and being a warrior in the middle of your struggles and coming up with your truth. That's what it's more about, isn't it?
Isn't that wonderful, Veronica? Yes, that's right on.
Yeah.
And the story of the Gita is set on a battlefield, as you started to talk about before.
Yeah, why don't you illuminate everybody on that?
Okay.
You do a good job in your book, I'll tell you.
It's a wonderful little, it's a big, long story, by the way. It's a The Gita, think of it as a half-inch thick poem smack in the middle of a two-inch thick epic poem from ancient India.
Hmm.
And part of that long epic story was a battle. As you so nicely put it, this family was really gypped out of their kingdom. The royalty was gone, and they had to fight a war to get it back. Well, at the beginning of that war, Arjuna, the warrior prince, who was the greatest man of action of his time, he was the hero. He was the one that everybody named their children after and so forth. So he's very famous, but here's this great warrior with a whole life behind him of super strength and so forth. He started shaking, and it wasn't so much that he was afraid, but that he was in deep anguish.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, nothing made sense to him. And he looked across the bay. He had his friend, a great friend of his from boyhood, a fellow named Krishna, who was actually an avatar, a full Purna avatar, was driving his chariot for him and going to be driving the chariot in battle. And this Prince Arjuna looked at him and said, "What's this all about?" In essence, he just slipped to his knees and his eyes filled with tears. He said, "I see people there that I want to love. I don't want to kill them." Mm-hmm. And he dropped his bow and arrow on the floor of the chariot. He said, "I refuse to fight." So the next thing, was surprisingly for everybody, knowing that Krishna was an avatar, except Arjuna didn't know yet, but the next thing Krishna, rather than supporting him in this non-fighting, said, "Why are you so weak-kneed about this? Don't you realize that it's your duty, that whatever your duty is, you've got to live it in this life?" And then he went and spent the next 20 or 30 minutes giving him the teachings, these principles that are laid out in the Bhagavad Gita.
It was so impressive. And also what he said, the thing, one of the things that just hit me like a ton of bricks was, of course, you know, you were never born and you never die.
Yes. Right.
And the Atma, what is it? You're talking about the Atma, which is the, you carry on with that part.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's interesting because what Krishna did immediately, seeing this fellow who was shaking and really in such a weakened state that he couldn't do anything, he immediately zoomed up into very high philosophical kind of ideas. And he said, he taught him what nowadays is known as Sankhya Yoga, which is really the knowledge of the self, the true self. And that was primarily in chapter 2 of the Gita. That's the chapter that Gandhi used to read when he was in his deepest, darkest time, sitting in prison somewhere, wondering whether this movement of his to free 400 million souls from tyranny, whether that was going to really work or not. Well, whenever he got way down, he would read chapter 2. And I just spent part of this morning reading it, and it's just wonderful to read it and reread it. And it's about this Sankhya Yoga, which is knowledge of the spirit. And what he said to Arjuna is, "Arjuna, your problem is that you're ignorant of who you really are. You are far, far more than you think you are, Arjuna." And then he went on to explain that you are the Atma, which is a part of the divinity that's in you. So you are that. And that's a very famous Sanskrit saying, Tattvamasi, you are that. So,
I like one of the lines you say here that he says to Arjuna, this egoistic self-indulgence at the time of crisis is shameful and unworthy of you. That is a very powerful line, isn't it?
Isn't that wonderful? I know it. He knew right away that this weakness of Arjuna is really an ego issue rather than a sannyasi issue. Arjuna was trying to make believe that he was going to go into a cave somewhere and live forever and be deeply into quietism.
And that's what a sannyasi is, renunciate, is it?
Yes, it's a renunciate, total renunciate.
Mm-hmm.
And Krishna, in effect, says, your karma and your life, you've been trained over many lifetimes, you've trained yourself to be a great warrior, and you've got to live that. You mm-hmm. can't go against your own inner truth.
And how you would lose all the respect of the people that you're supposedly saving or leading, right?
That was one of his worldly arguments.
Mm-hmm.
The truth that you should live up to is the truth inside of yourself, which is nothing other than divinity. But even if you don't believe that or if you can't understand that yet, then look at it from a worldly standpoint. All the people who have loved you and revered you and worshiped you all these years as a great hero, they would laugh at you and mock you.
But in the search for divinity or improving the divinity within any of us, how do we make peace with fighting and battle?
The main thing we've got to look at is, in this instance, is that the fight, the battle, is really not that external battle. See, this is sort of a device used in the Bhagavad Gita. The battle is internal. we have to battle our own inner weaknesses. We have to battle our own disappointments and our fear and our angers and our self-doubts and all that stuff, and come out victorious. And the way we do that is by spiritualizing our life.
Hmm.
The aim is eventually so to get ourselves into a position where we can walk through a life of sadness and see nothing but love, or walk through a life of cruelty or evil and see nothing but love. To walk through all of the self-doubts that assail us and see nothing but love.
Hmm.
And that's really the whole underlying current here.
Well, and at one point, the writing includes when you're in action, there are three kinds of karma it talks about, the karma of the future. Well, you can talk about this.
Okay. Oh, good. Yeah, three karmas. Well, actually, there are three main ways of changing. One is changing through knowing, which was jnana yoga. J-N-A-N-A is pronounced jnana. It's a funny little nasal sound. Jnana yoga, which is really knowing that inner and internal self. Second way is through action, through being a karma yogi, and that's what I think you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, and if you live up to a karma yoga through certain practices, then you can actually obviate or dismember all three yogas that are assailing you at any given time. One is your future yoga, one is your past yoga, and the other is the yoga that you've earned for this lifetime that you're currently living your life or living your way through. And it might be very difficult for you, it might be very painful, but through these practices, you can actually eliminate the effects of them. You're not going to eliminate the karma, but you're going to be able to sail through those terribly rocky white waters and come out of it smiling.
But doesn't it imply that you could actually neutralize karma?
Yes. Oh, not imply. It absolutely proves it.
Okay. So how do we do that, Jack?
Oh, boy. You know better than I do. When we get into the how-tos, it makes it a lot harder. Let me go back one step again. Through
sure.
Three main paths to that. That objective of, let's call it, self-realization, mm-hmm. of becoming an enlightened being. The three main paths are knowing, acting, and loving. And it's a three-legged stool, Veronica. None of them is more important than the other. We have to have all three. We have to pursue all three paths in a balanced way. My wife, for example, is very loving. She takes to that so nicely and so quickly, and yet, early on in our studies, through some of my balancing of helping her, she saw clearly that, yes, she also couldn't overlook the yoga or the union, the path of union through knowing, or she couldn't overlook the karma yogi path, the path of union with divinity through action. So it's not just one or the other ones are the one that we are most taken with. Okay, so getting to your question, got awfully tough question, awfully easy to ask.
You can handle it, I know you can.
Oh, well, thank you, I need that. But the path of action is mainly made up in our worldly world of service, being service to others. But if we add then to that, knowing that we are indeed divinity, and then through much persistence and constant spiritual practicing, through developing our capacity for loving at the very, very highest level, loving beyond a mere romantic relationship between two separate egos, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
If we mix all that together, then one of the good outcomes is that whatever the karma is that's assailing us, past, future, or present, we can handle with aplomb. We can handle it with absolutely no care, no concern whatsoever. And now let me keep getting into the main way, of course, and you know this as well as anyone on the planet, is through purifying the mind, learning to shift, make the great, magnificent shift in consciousness away from that fearfulness, that cruelty, the injustice, and so forth, shifting it, all of that, toward pure love at the very level of divinity.
It's almost like understanding that we're all divinity, but we're here through the illusion, and none of it is that important.
Krishna makes that so clear in the Gita, too. I mean, we all know that. The nice thing about this Bhagavad Gita, Veronica, is that we all sort of wander. All of the people I get into spirituality that I know, and I know, you know, thousands of them like you do, they all they don't quite know how to grasp it. It's so huge. It's so vast. And it's, by definition, it's so subtle. It's not quite concrete for many people. But what the Gita does, I think, is make all of that complete. Anything that people want to learn more about or study more about or whatever, I have found to be in the Gita. If it's not in the Gita, it's probably nowhere.
Well, it's interesting because, for example, one of the tools that it teaches is you have an attitude of sacrifice. And in our day and age, it's really interesting because we are learning not to self-sacrifice over and over again. So I jumped into that section of the book just chewing it up like mad. And it's got such a different interpretation, which is not of the slaying of, maybe the slaying of the ego, but not of the slaying of the self, but appreciating everything as coming from divinity and reaching out and, I don't know how you would explain it, maybe pushing past what your thought might be in order to contribute to life, would you say?
Oh, nice. Yes, you put your thumb right on it, and that's such an important thing. This is the essence, I think, of the path of karma yoga, the action path to unity, is to, through service, which is sacrifice, to get into a sort of a constant awareness of sacrifice as a cornerstone for to our spiritual development. But sacrifice, not in the usual way we think of it as you know, sacrificing an animal or berating ourselves or belittling ourselves, but sacrifice in the great sense of serving others, of helping, of contributing to the welfare of the entire planet.
And it's not a long-suffering kind of approach.
Oh, heavens no. It's just the opposite. It's just the opposite, interestingly.
It's kind of recognizing and appreciating the wonder of everything that comes to us that we can participate in a way.
Oh, nice.
I found.
Nice, so nicely put. Thank you for that, yes.
It's pretty interesting. So tell me this, Jack, in all of your studies, you've been working with this for, what, 30 years, haven't you?
Yes.
And do you find that you have other lives that were way back when, in the earlier times of India?
Well, yes, but I've never paid much attention to them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but yes, I have. And one lifetime, my wife and I were both warriors. Very close friends. Both of us were males in that lifetime. And then in other lifetimes we were together also. But that's those kind of things. The question that always leaps in my mind is, why do I want to know it? And one of the answers is, well, it's very interesting. I'd love to know that stuff. Then the question keeps dogging me, but why? Why? It's an internal, very deep internal question. And for me, Veronica, the answer is not valuable enough to spend an awful lot of my energy on.
Okay, well, I was being kind of playful with it, feeling that the depth that you had of understanding of this, I go, this fellow has been a participant in this knowledge for a long, long time.
Well, that's true. That really is true. And it doesn't matter. the closer I inch toward realization, the less all of these other things matter.
Wonderful.
Even the less realization itself matters.
That's because you're not dragging your karma around.
So, or right. because the fear factor is lessening more and more and more until it's almost extinguished completely. Or because the love factor, there's such a stream of love constantly flowing in my mind that it changes everything else.
And so Gandhi, jumping back to your talking about chapter 2, and Gandhi, that's what he was trying to teach, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He was a very human man, but living at a very high yogi level. And he would look into the Bhagavad Gita. He read the Gita every day. He'd look into the Bhagavad Gita, and he'd draw from that all of the things that he needed to be that supremely powerful human being that he was.
He certainly did make a difference, didn't he?
He certainly did, yeah. Really, and he made a difference without ever firing a gun.
What do you think is happening in today's world? Do you think that talking about Gandhi or you are making a difference using this kind of, inner technology, I guess we could call it?
Nice.
Do you think it's, what's happening with it? Are more and more people getting connected to it?
I don't know. I get that question a lot.
Gee, I thought I was being original.
No. Well, you know, you get it all the time too. It's an interesting question. It comes to me. You know, I used to do it. I haven't done many lately, but I used to do a lot of seminars for managers and leaders using spiritual principles. I wrote one of the first. It was the first book ever, by the way. It was Spirit, a management book with Spirit in the title back 19, 20 years ago. And it became a bestseller. So it was.
What was it called? I'll look it up.
Okay, it's called Reawakening the Spirit and Work.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Then the second, the other subtitle was The Power of Dharmic Management. Dharma, meaning living your life by your inner truth or doing right actions throughout life, whatever. But anyway, I get that question from that particular audience a lot, saying, do you think that there is a groundswell of this? And my own perception, and it could well be wrong, and I hope so, but my own perception is no. I think it's spreading a lot. I'm just amazed, by the way, is that when I go through your website and see all of the wonderful work and that you've done and so many people that you've reached out to and had on your talk show. So I think that there seems to be a spreading of it, especially now in our electronic era. But I don't know if it's a groundswell. I know people talk about it a lot more easily. I think there are 80-some-odd management books out there now with the spirit in the title of them.
Oh, wonderful. Well, there's a whole movement to consciousness in business, isn't there?
Well, quotes, movement, end quotes.
There's a lot of corporate dominance as well. I realize that.
Well, and also it seems to me, my own experience is that they can do this when times are easy and they'll indulge themselves and they really will really like it. But then when times get tough and hard, they pull back. And unfortunately, they pull back out of their heart and into their head. And start looking at numbers and worrying that way.
So when people start to look after their own territory, they were back in the old style, really, hey?
They start graduating from fear, and then when times get tough, they slide back into fear, a fear-based kind of orientation.
That's kind of frustrating. So we've been looking at the Middle East. Thank you for that. We've been looking at the Middle East and that the Egyptian, the movement to bring Mubarak off, it was a huge peace movement, wasn't it?
Oh, isn't it wonderful? Yeah, some of this is very exciting for us. But I'd hasten to add that from the standpoint of high spirituality, it's all just part of what happens in the world. It's all the world rolling along. If we were... if you and I were talking 20 years ago, it would be some other issues that we're dealing with. If we were talking 200 years ago, it would be some others. If it was 1,000 years ago, we'd be two peasants sitting in sackcloth on a rock somewhere talking about how the world is changing so much and how it's so difficult to get food now or whatever.
So it doesn't really matter at what time we are. I'm reading here, it says, for a warrior, war against evil, greed, cruelty, hate, and jealousy is the highest duty. Mm-hmm. I'm going, well, I guess that's not new and that's not old.
Right. Forever, isn't it?
That's just the way it is.
It really is. And look at this wonderful Gita story. There are some people, and I think they make a good argument, that would argue that this story began 27,000 years ago, before the last ice age.
Oh, really?
And then it picked up after the last ice age, at least the line of it that we know. So it's tremendously old, and yet it's so relevant now.
Hmm. And that's because the inner part of us isn't the part that leads into the government. I mean, it doesn't create the governments and so on, does it?
Repeat that again.
I just jumped to a conclusion that might be wrong, but I was just thinking that's because the inner journey, being a warrior about your inner self and so on, that has not necessarily anything to do with government or world systems.
It has nothing to do with government and world systems other than putting up with it or other than contributing light to that huge conglomeration or whatever we can do that's helpful for the higher good of everything and everybody in it. But other than, you know, so that karma yoga aspect of it is, I think, very salient, but it has nothing to do with knowing the truth of our inner self, mm-hmm. or really with, it has less to do with loving. But loving, of course, is everything. Loving is our ultimate graduation from fear.
Hmm. That's a really big job. Let's see what happens with Arjuna, if you can tell people. They're on the battlefield, and I was chuckling as I was reading yesterday when Krishna was explaining things to Arjuna, and I could imagine this humongous battlefield. Of course, we've only seen things like that in the movies, and I don't know if they'd have a pause quite that long. So tell people at home what happens when they resume. What happens after the discussion on the battlefield, where Krishna tells Arjuna about the inner warrior?
Oh, good. Did you get to that part, by the way?
I got to about halfway through the book.
Okay, good. Okay.
Sorry, but I am going to read the whole thing.
You've done awfully good already. This, by the way, can I veer something, talking a little bit more about the book?
Of course.
I developed this book after that initial reaction of, no, I didn't want to do it because I knew it was going to be too hard work.
Right.
Finally, I gave in, quotes gave in. And when I made the decision that, yes, I'm going to do it, then everything, the universe came to my rescue immediately, and books started dropping in my lap, falling off of shelves toward me. People would meet me on the street and hand me a book. A woman from Southern California, who a very spiritual woman, gave me a 18-volume set of commentary on the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, my.
So so suddenly I was inundated with 40,000 pages of commentary on the Gita. And Veronica, I read every one of them.
My gosh.
I loved it. I mean, it was just so nice for me to get that deeply involved in it.
Wow.
And then, out of all of that, and by the way, each one of those commentaries were maybe 1,000 pages long. So out of all of that came this little 190-page book. And my main guide in this was, again, inner guidance, and it was a message, Krishna can stand on his own two feet. Well, I didn't know what that meant at first, you know, like a lot of times in these things. I thought, what does that mean? And slowly, as I worked through this, my writing, it came clear that this had to be a very unique Gita. It couldn't be a commentary on it. It couldn't be an explanation of those very complicated, sometimes deeply esoteric teachings of this great avatar, it had to be his words standing up for themselves and be totally understandable as you walk through the whole thing.
The essence of it all.
That's right. Well, it's not only the essence, but it's the every one of the teachings, too.
Wow.
Yeah, there are 65 major teachings, 700 different verses in the original, 65 major teachings, and every one of them had to come through clearly as if Krishna were talking to you and I, as if we were flies on the wall of that battlefield and listening to him teaching his beloved Arjuna.
Hmm. How long did it take you to write the book then? It must have been a long process.
Well, well, 3 years. 24/7.
Wow.
And during that time, we had to come home every once in a while and see the family and help out in that way. And also, I had to come back and do some of my consulting. So it was a packed 3 year, packed and wondrous.
But I have to say to you that that explains why, as I'm reading this, I go, this fellow has to have steeped in this. He must be 4,000 years old in soul and already experienced in the Gita. You know what I mean? So you've obviously permeated yourself with the wisdom.
Well, the...
you can feel it in the book, I tell everybody at home.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that. Thank you. That really is makes me feel very good.
Good.
And that's true. I've lived this so many lifetimes, and I've started so many thousands of years ago. I think we can talk. Maybe there are three levels of Jack Hawley that wrote this book. One of them is Jack Hawley, the regular guy from upstate New York who found himself through various worldly issues here, various deaths too in his life, by the way, found himself going into spirituality. Or another level of Jack Hawley would be Jack Hawley, the really earnest spiritual seeker. The person who, with his wife, went to India and spent the better part of 30 years living there, living in a little tiny room. We love our place there, but it's very small, very simple, away from worldliness and deeply into a place where they're living the teachings of the Gita.
Wonderful.
And finally, there's the mystical one. And this is the one I think that you so quickly... latch onto, and that is the mystical person who's, in a way, getting some messages that are very important to share in this particular time in this world. And that one is one that most people can understand. Of course, that's the first thing you understand, I think.
Yeah. Well, you have a gift of presentation, which... A gift is a very important thing, isn't it?
You know, my wife said she would come in the room when I'm working in India. I had a little table over under the window. She'd come in and she'd see light where I was sitting.
Mm.
Now, I never saw it. I revert back to that regular guy from upstate New York. But she would see light and she would know. And she would know that something special was happening.
Well, I have a small story that's just a little bit probably smaller than what you're just saying now, which is quite wonderful and impressive. But I just went back in time and read the autobiography of a yogi, and I got absolutely entranced all over again and learned a lot from it this time. It's good to reread something. And at the end I said, you know, I need to read the Gita, and your book came in the mail the next day from New World Library.
See, the universe.
I opened it and went, no, I can't believe this.
Oh, wonderful.
So you're meant to be on my list here.
Thank you, and I'm delighted that I was meant to be there.
So tell us more about it. I love what you said about yourself and your three aspects of yourself. I'm an intuitive, and my listeners are all really aware that many of us are functioning on many levels, and so that was wonderful information. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And so let's go a little farther with Arjuna. Did he ever get back into the battle?
Oh, yeah. Well, oh, yes. He after this 20-minute or half-hour teaching by Krishna, which goes throughout the Gita, 18 chapters of the Gita. Then,
oh, and I want to interrupt you just for a sec. Where, who was the fellow begins with S who was kind of telling what was being said to King.
That's a nice device. That was a man named Sanjaya.
Yeah, lovely.
Who I think that word in Sanskrit means sort of the person whose soul is totally truthful or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, Sanjaya was an aide to the opposing king. Now, the opposing king's sons were the ones that Arjuna had to do battle with.
Mm-hmm.
So this old man, he's a blind old man, and he knew Arjuna from his youth. He helped bring him up, as a matter of fact. But this old king was dying to know what was going on in the battlefield, which I think was maybe 20 miles or so away from where they were sitting. So Arjuna had the yogic power to see and hear everything that was going on there. So this book is Sanjaya's. Did I say Arjuna? I meant Sanjaya. This book is Sanjaya's retelling of what's going on, relating what's going on to this old blind king.
Yeah, well, he's like the sports commentator in a way.
That's exactly right.
I loved his role. Anyway, that was a small interruption, but a worthy one, I hope.
And, you know, it was interesting because he's a very honest person, so he's not going to play the game. And it was really a cruel game that the opposing army was playing. This is indeed, and it makes, for some people, it makes the war a little bit more palatable, is because it's a righteous war. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know, I think that's a great, it's a funny...
Oxymoron.
Oxymoron, yeah. But anyway, it's determined to be a righteous war, so and it really, they were in the right in that sense, so maybe that is righteous. But... So Sanjaya wouldn't play the games of this old fellow, or this old blind king. He'd just tell him the truth, and he rattled it off as it went.
I really liked that.
Yes, I do. The whole thing is, it's a piece of literature that I thoroughly love.
And the way you've written it up here, it's easy to read, and I don't mean that in a cheeky way. It's just that you have to go back and really cogitate some of the things you're reading, but it's an easy read, and that's a blessing, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think you're going to have to read it a lot of times to really glean it. You know, it's like you're saying reading the autobiography of a yogi. Reading it this many years later, of course, you're a different person.
Yes.
And it's I love that. I did the same thing a couple of years ago with that book. It's just, I got 80% more out of it the second time around than I did the first time.
Me too. I started giving it to everybody I knew. So what happens? Let's take us on back to the battlefield and the and it is an interesting fight given our whole mortgage thing these days and that whole corporate swindle.
Yes, it really is.
Yeah,
and it's and there are some I think very close parallels. Really.
Tremendously close parallels.
It doesn't take spinning around. It just takes looking a little bit in a different direction and seeing those parallels.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the book proceeds through first teaching Arjuna how to know the truth of himself, then teaching him how to act in life, and then helping him become more and more of the loving truth that's within him. And then it ends. And it ends with, in essence, Krishna saying, now you know what's up, and you must make your own mind up about what to do. And Arjuna, by that time, is thoroughly understanding. And he right away shook his head yes. He said, I will go into battle and I'll fight because I know that that's my duty and it's a righteous thing. And not only that, but if I don't, I'll be going against my inner truth, which is the biggest no-no of all. So he does that. He goes to battle. Now, the Gita ends there, but let me explain a little bit what happened in the battle.
Okay.
In this long Mahabharata is the long, long poem that I was referring to, the epic.
Mahabharata?
Mahabharata, yes.
Okay.
Yes, you spelled it right. That's right. So anyway, he goes into battle. He's the greatest warrior of ever. People on the other side would stop every once in a while because he's such a great fighter and just watch him. I mean, it was like you go on a dance floor stopping to see a particular couple dancing because it was so enchanting. So he did wonderfully except even with him, and by that time, by the way, he was fully aware that Krishna was an avatar, that he was indeed a full incarnation of divinity on this on this planet in a human body. So Arjuna knew all that. He was fully versed. He had all the knowledge in him, and he pledged to his beloved friend Krishna that he would fight this battle and win it. Well, at certain times in the battle, this is fascinating, even with that pledge, even with him making an absolute eyeball-to-eyeball promise to God, Arjuna would falter. He would see somebody on the other side that he loved, or that he would come up against some great warrior that he really had great feeling for, and he wouldn't be able to pull the string on his bow and arrow. So he would falter. Krishna, at those times, he was only a chariot driver, because he would refuse to fight. He was just part of his being an avatar. He could never fight. But he did drive the chariot. So he would jump out of the chariot and make believe that he is all angry or disappointed in Arjuna to get him back into that mood of doing, of living by his own inner truth, of living his dharma.
Wow.
I know.
Did he actually, then did he win or do we know?
Oh, yes. Oh, they won. Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, they won. The big epic poem, the Mahabharata, is that they won, and they took back their kingdom, and they lived a certain number of years, not too many, and they died off and went to various levels of beyond worlds.
And they didn't track them there, I'll bet.
They did. They tracked some of them into the one of the highest levels. They call them the lokas. One of the high, they track them into the highest levels. But the whole teaching, though, and you'll get to this later in the book, the whole teaching is to go beyond even those. We must learn to transcend and to rise higher than Arjuna and all of these great warriors and all these great spiritual people. There's no other goal than to achieve our own divinity within. And when we do that, then we're there. Then we can make up our own mind about whether we come back or whether we never come back.
And we can choose whether to come back, can we not?
Yes, we can. According to those teachings, it's at that point, when we get there, yes. Beyond, before we get there, no, we can't choose. We'll come back based on the consciousness level that we leave this particular lifetime.
I like the section that says that we can actually get through our karma if we have the right attitude at the time.
And that's, by the way, that's absolutely true.
Well, I want that.
Well, then you're going to get it. Absolutely.
Now, I like that you say that. Now, you also, you broke it into three sections, part one, part two, and part three. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Okay.
Because that's useful for all of us, isn't it?
I know. And it was, you know, the way this thing unfolded for me was just miraculous in the true meaning of that word. The first six chapters, 18 chapters, the first six chapters are oriented toward that knowing, getting to know the truth of yourself. The main way of doing that, by the way, is through self-inquiry. That's the main. 70% of our spiritual practice is self-inquiry.
And what does self-inquiry look like? I know that Byron Katie teaches that, and so did Ramana Maharshi, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, it looks very. It's exactly that. They've both pulled that from the teachings in the Gita.
Aha.
See, oh, yeah, Ramana and Byron Katie, yes. I think they'd be the first to say that.
I remember Maharshi's, one of his meditation mantras was, who am I?
Who am I? That's right. And he's so wonderful, the quintessential Indian holy man. So
yes.
Wonderful. He who am I? And he would work that and continue working it. That's the only three words that he'd ever ask, who am I? And teach people to achieve their own realization of their own divinity through those three little words.
So as you ask those three little words, then what rises in us, is this right? Is it rises bits and pieces of ourself and our knowing and our subterfuges or our deception?
That's right, thank you. Yes, all those things. Getting more of a handle on our ego, getting much more of a handle on this mind that deludes us so quickly and readily and often and always. Getting, finding out who is this person, who am I? Who is this person that's so fearful or that's acting in these funny ways? Yeah, so that's that would be self-inquiry in that sense.
And then self-action, selfless action, that's part of the sacrifice part too, isn't
it? That's right. And then, so that first part of the Gita, thank you for that, is about knowing ourselves and then also about the value of selfless action. And selfless action is really, Krishna teaches a very practical spiritual discipline called karma yoga. And that's in the first part. So that's the combination of very high philosophy, way out in the atmosphere about knowing the true self within, and then very practical application of that here on the face of the earth.
The peanut butter and jelly.
Pardon?
The peanut butter and jelly.
Nice. Oh, how nice. I'm writing that down. Thank you. The second six chapters is really about the very nature of God. The very nature of divinity. See, as you so well know, as my guess is that in our, especially in our Western world, the idea that we call God is a very closed idea nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Because people all think that they know exactly who God is and is their God and nobody else's, and so forth. You know the whole rigmarole.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the Gita, it teaches us what this. The idea of divinity really means what it really is. And it's the most sublime exposition of what God really is in all of the literature of the world. I've never come across anything that's anywhere near as clear. And at the end of that, the six chapters is chapter 12, of course, first six chapters, then chapter 7 through 12. In chapter 12, then we get to know how much we can love and adore and be devoted to this entity that we're referring to as divinity. And that entity, by the way, is not an entity out there. It's an entity within.
Hmm.
So it's the second cluster of six chapters is all about knowing God so that you can love that even more.
Hmm. And love is an infinitely expanding part, isn't it?
Loving is not just a feeling. That's the hardest thing for us to wean ourselves from, to realize that love is something so much greater, such a force in our world, rather than a feeling that we have towards something else in the world.
Mm-hmm. It's a real, not an enigma. Yeah, maybe it is an enigma sometimes. Way bigger than we think.
Yeah, bigger and far bigger. An interesting thing, by the way, in that first book we mentioned earlier about reawakening the spirit and work, I knew that with that audience I had to tackle that tough issue of what love really is.
Hmm.
So I meditated on that for a long time, and I ended up with a model for love called the Six Landscapes of Love that roamed all the way from love as pure desire and lust through various steps. The final one is love as being, as a spirit, as very high spirit.
Wow, it's something. That's wonderful. I'll have to get a hold of that book, I think.
Okay. yes, well, let's talk about that afterward because I'd be glad to see to that.
Thank you.
So getting back to this, so then the final six chapters are how to apply all this. Or they're generally oriented toward, okay, now that we know what we're supposed to know, and now that we know what divinity is and what our relationship to that should be, now let's look at how can we actually spiritualize our lives? How can we live a spiritual life in this world that doesn't seem to be very supportive of people who want to live a spiritual, holy spiritual life.
The challenge.
Yes, the challenge is right.
Mm-hmm.
So those are that's the Gita.
This is very exciting. And the name, give people the name of the book again.
Okay. It's the Bhagavad Gita, A Walkthrough for Westerners. No, Bhagavad is B-H-A-G-A-V-A-D. There are a few other little spellings. If you see it with a T in there somewhere, don't worry about it because it's all the same thing. But it's the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad means it's related to lordliness or to celestial being or to God or to divinity. Mm-hmm. And Gita is the Sanskrit word for song. So Bhagavad Gita is the song of divinity.
How wonderful. What a great name.
It's a wonderful name.
I love this book. And your name is Jack Hawley, H-A-W-L-E-Y. And do you have a website that you'd like people to?
Yes, thanks. It's, people can learn a lot more about me and this book and why I love it so much on the website. And it's called GitaWalkthrough.com. That's G-I-T-A, and then walk through, both words spelled out completely, all one word, by the way, GitaWalkthrough.com.
Wonderful. Well,
and I'll see you there. I'll be glad to meet you there.
That would be just absolutely wonderful. I've so enjoyed our talk today, and thank you so much for joining us on Paradigm Shifters. And also, you make this book so... This book is so, as I say, I know we need to study it a lot, but it's so readable. I want people to know to grab hold of it and get the ancient wisdom that's just permeating this book.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've really liked being here with you.
Me too. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, that was Jack Hawley talking about the Gita. And oh my goodness, what a wonderful, wonderful book. I really recommend that you get hold of that book and give yourself some moral support as we carry on as paradigm shifters, making a difference from the inside out, being the warriors that we really are. Let's take a deep breath and out. And now this time, let's take a deep breath and bring in light. And bring in that infinite love that's everywhere and then breathe it out to our Paradigm Shifters community. Many blessings to everyone, and thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. My name is Veronica Entwistle. I'm an intuitive and energy counselor. And if you've got any feedback on Jack Hawley, if you have any suggestions for potential guests for this show, or if you'd like a session with me and my guides and angels, email me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. I'd love to chat with you. Many, many blessings. Thanks for listening, and good night.